My name's Billy, I'm an alcoholic. I'm so nervous. My main purpose right here, right now, is to open the door as wide as I can for anyone that's reaching out for help that has what I have, which is alcoholism. When I drank, every time I drank, I wanted more. And sometimes I stopped because the liquor store was closed. Sometimes I stopped because I passed out or was arrested. And sometimes I stopped because I just ran out of money. I didn't very much go robbing people or anything like that to have another drink, but I could drink for $3 to $6 a day, and I managed to do that. And this thing's almost empty. I just want to illustrate for the. There's more right there. Thank you, Andre. For the newcomer, just because I'm sober doesn't mean it isn't Miller time. It's Miller time. So I just want to give you an example of what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous if it's Miller time. I love to drink. If this is the end of my talk, I would certainly finish that. But I don't want to be carrying that much water for the whole meeting. It's really cool to see a bunch of people that I have known for a long time and a bunch of people that I just met.
Picture's worth a thousand words, and I'd like to pass this out because I had a lot of brain damage in the old days, and I don't know exactly how much my story's going to get out or whatever, but I may as well just pass them on out, huh? The main thing I want a newcomer to know, I know it's like to be wasted, and I know it's like to be sober. And how do I do it? What happened? What's it like to have? I've never passed them out one at a time before. In the past, it's kind of hands over, we got this thing, and hands down that way.
I like it. It's good.
You can see it.
Billy,
is that
your picture?
That's it.
The year
before I got sober.
Wow. Oh, no, yeah, I see it. But you just look a little like he's drunk right there.
Yeah. Lights were on, and the person that was home was not functioning. At that time, say in the year before I got sober, what I did for a living was I came to my normal day, and I swore it off. It was like 9 or 10, maybe 11 o'clock in the morning. And I lived a half a block from Carol's Restaurant and Radio Square Liquors, which was down at Carrillo and De La Vina Street in Santa Barbara. And I go over to Carol's and I get a couple of cups of coffee and I get a newspaper. And I go to Radio Square and get a pack of Camel Straights and head back over to my workshop. And in my workshop, I had a sewing machine. And I sit down at the sewing machine and just kind of come to and swear it off and eventually start doing some work. And the kind of work that I did was I would cut leather rectangles and sew them together. And it might be a drawstring pouch, two pieces of leather, and sew around three sides and punch holes in the top. It might be a zipper pouch where you cut rectangles, put them this way, and sew a zipper on that way. And sometimes I did some really complex stuff where I took about 10 or 15 rectangles and sewed them all together, and that was a handbag. And what I did for a living in those days was what people do in a psych ward for just getting their mind off of things. Anyhow, so that was me in that picture. And generally, about 2 or 3 in the afternoon, someone would stop by with a six-pack and they need something repaired. Or right next door to me, there was an auto repair shop. And they would say, hey, we'll buy if you fly. And so I made a backpack, like the highlight of my social standing in those days was I had a backpack that I made to hold a 12-pack of beer, and you could lay a bottle of vodka down on top of it and a bottle of cranberry juice. And I'd hop on my bike and zoom across Carrillo Street, which back in those days it was safe to do that. It was a little risky, but I was pretty quick on the bike and over to Radio Square Liquor, and there'd be three people in line waiting to pay for their alcohol. And I would just go in and grab my 12-pack and the bottle of vodka, whatever I needed, and throw them in the backpack, go to the counter aside from the line, throw them in the backpack, put exact change on the counter, and wave at Casey, the manager. And I was cool because I didn't have to stand in line at the liquor store. It reminds me, like, some people in their drinking days, they wouldn't go back to the same place to drink because they didn't want people to know. And in sobriety, there was a point in time where I quit smoking cigarettes, and I turned to ice cream, and I would go to different stores to buy ice cream. I didn't want people knowing I was a pig. I didn't care if they knew I was an alcoholic, but I didn't want them to know I was a pig. Anyhow, so that's how that was. So on the day I was born, I had four sisters, and by the time I was 6 years old, I had eight sisters. And my brother, thank God, came along when I was 8 years old. But the deal growing up as a Catholic family, a devout Catholic family, it was like some darkness, some, you know, like secrets kind of stuff going on that we don't talk about anything outside of the house and so on. And but we managed to pull it off of in public being good Catholic family. And in private, among ourselves, among the siblings, we cared about each other, and we did a pretty good job of getting along. I remember being the only guy. I went through, like, being the total center of attention, which I could do that to this day without much problem if I know what to say. But either total center of attention, or else all of a sudden the girls are having a hen party, and I'm isolated. And I'm totally locked out of the society that I'm aware of, my home life. I'm totally locked out of that. And there was times when, for whatever kind of misbehaving, I got locked into my room. They put a hook lock on the outside, and I get locked in there. And sometimes they forgot about me all day. And I was just in there. And growing up, I'm going to use the J word once or twice, but Jesus was my best friend growing up. My dad was gone a lot, and so he was surrounded by women, and he was like my primary male role model. So if you're me at my age, locked in your room with holy books galore, I probably didn't even know how to read at that time, but definitely crucifixes on the wall and pictures on the wall and all that stuff. So hanging out with Jesus was something I learned how to do. And hanging out, being alone, is something I learned how to do. And there was sometimes they forgot to let me out. It'd be dinner time. Oh, no. Oh, hey, Billy, oh, we're so sorry, and so on. And just, okay. And I just, I don't know, like, some kind of apathy comes to me easily. Not these days, but in those days. It's like, oh, well, you know, whatever. And at the end of my drinking days, like, I heard someone sharing at a meeting recently about despair. And to me, despair was a step up from where I was at, because I was apathetic. At just whatever. I didn't despair at losing my life or losing relationships or losing. I just woke up, swore it off. Sometime later in the day, got started again, and got wasted till I couldn't get wasted anymore, and then woke up and swore it off. But anyhow, so I got locked in my room so much, and it wasn't like every day. I don't know how much it was, but I know that there was a point in time when I put a hook lock on the inside and they went to unlock me and they were locked out. And that's things that I come up with, you know, in my creativeness. And anyhow, so let's see. So this is up in Seattle, and across the street from where I grew up, the whole city block was a Catholic Girls Academy. And I mean, when I said surrounded by women, I was surrounded by women. And I carried the, I went to the grocery store with my mom. I carried the 50-pound sacks of potatoes. I helped her figure out she'd have all the coupons for this store and that, and this coupon for six different stores to make the money stretch out. Can you hear me okay back there? Okay. So I'm making the money stretch out, and so I was always logistically involved in what was going on and physically involved. And sister needs something, reach from the high shelf and grab that, or can you open this jar or whatever, can you this, can you that, and I thought I had life figured out. You may just do whatever she wants and she'll love you. And that's, you know, I got retarded in some ways from growing up where love and attention was so easy. But on the other hand, I enjoy love and attention this day, right here, right now, because I know how to share, how to show respect, how to listen, how to treat each person as a human being that has the possibility of living a human life as apart from the life of an alcoholic. Each of us very closely resembles each other in our alcoholism, you know, just wasted, not measuring up, not happy, frustrated, angry, lost, demoralized, all those kind of things. In sobriety, we share this gift, this common bond. We've absolutely found a way upon which we can agree, we, you know, a way out. But I bet you there's no one in this room. I know there's no one in this room that cooks chocolate the way I do. I know there's nobody that cuts tile like Jim does, or something like that. I know there's no one here that cuts leather like I do, and so on. There's no one that shares like Estella shared last Saturday, and there's no one who digs deeper and drills down on the details of shortcomings and character defects like Trish, and so on. Nobody signs court cards like John, and no one took care of her parents like Bunny, and so on. And over time, you know, no one shows up through all kinds of hard things, you know, one day at a time. I mean, each of us. So the lives that we live in sobriety, I don't have grandkids. I don't have children. I don't have not in a relationship. But I have a relationship with God. I have a relationship within myself. I have an internal life that is flourishing most of the time, and so on. And so growing up, another thing, having four older siblings, doesn't matter if it's sisters or could have been brothers, and four younger ones, is as a middle child, you're watching out for everybody. You're watching out for this one, you know, this one saying, hey, Billy, can you, you know, if Jeff calls, tell him I'm getting ready. And that's my older sister, you know, or my little brother saying, hey, I can't get my hand out of there, or whatever. And you're just in the middle, you're just watching out. So anyhow, so I have that, and that's not a bad thing. And anyhow, so fast forward, I had buddies in the neighborhood a bit, not a whole lot, and I went to a Catholic grammar school, and it was all guys until I think I was in the fifth or sixth grade, and then they started mixing them. But when I was in seventh grade, we moved to Santa Barbara. And in Santa Barbara, it was a relief for me. It was just up there, Seattle. Seattle's beautiful. I was just up there a couple weeks ago. But it's gray a lot. I remember when it rains, you get out in the gutter and build dams out of leaves in the fall. My immediate younger sister and my immediate older sister is Teresa and Sheila. They were cohorts in lots of ways. My sister Teresa and I, we painted, did some painting. My dad was painting the inside of the house or something. We took it on ourselves to paint this one door like green and pink and white or I don't know what, and caught a little trouble for it when Dad got home. But anyhow, so when we moved down here, it was a mixed school. It was a Catholic school, and there was a guy that took it on himself to bully me, like I was new to the area or whatever. And he had me wrapped around my chest or wrapped around my neck, like to show me who's tough on this school ground. And if he had me around the chest, I'd grab him around the neck. And if he had me around the neck, I'd grab him around the chest. But I gave him a squeeze till he let go and established myself as being someone that I'm one of the guys. And that was cool. And did some sports and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, I went to Bishop High School. I was super bright. I played football the first couple years, played varsity basketball when I was a sophomore. I was on the bench, but I was 6 feet tall, and that helped at a Catholic high school. And about junior and senior years, I got into student government, and I was elected student body president in 1966. For the school year 66-67, and that year the school needed to be accredited. And while everyone's either playing football or they're doing this or they're doing that, they put me in charge of the accreditation. It was that every 5 years the school has to be accredited, and all the faculty and staff were busy with stuff, and they put me in charge of it because they knew I could do it. And I did it, and I could come and go to classes whenever I wanted to, and it was about about 23-page questionnaire or something like that, and all the students and all the faculty had to fill it out, and I was in charge of collating it and coming up with a report. And that's the level of skill set or willingness to help or being able to wrap my head around complex things or whatever at that time. And I had the top SAT score in my high school. I could have gone to any college in California without even applying for a scholarship. I just automatically got it. But I put the paperwork on my dad's desk and it fell through the cracks, and he didn't fill it out and I didn't get the scholarship. And to me it was fine. It was like, well, someone else needs it more than I do. And at that time, you know, to me life was just, you know, college was for people who can't figure out life as they go along and they need to be told what to think about. And so for me to get in college is to take that space away from someone else. And two was, I thought I'd marry my high school sweetheart and figure out things as we go along, make babies and figure it out. Well, it turned out, and this shows you my communication skills, we were together for like a year and a half, and I had no idea that she wanted to go to school and be a teacher. You know, I thought we'd just get out of high school, get married, start making babies. Anyhow, she went to Florida State. Her dad got a job back there, and she went to Florida State in Tallahassee, and we wrote from long distance, and I went out there at Christmas time and saw her, and it was great. But I had a cousin that came here from Seattle, and she was a single mom, and she was 21, and me and a couple buddies, anyhow, we started drinking. And through high school, I drank now and then, like when my sister got married, or every now and then there'd be a party where there was alcohol. And if I drank, I drank till I was cut off, but I didn't go into fits or tantrums if I couldn't drink anymore. I just drank however much I could. But after high school, and the Vietnam War was going on, this is 1967, and after high school, my cousin comes to town, and we start smoking dope and drinking, and by March, like 3 months after I was in Florida to see my sweetheart, it was her birthday, and I'm on the phone cussing her out. Like, I look back on that, I was like, just alcohol and pot took me there as far as piecing things together, as far as having in your heart, having in my heart what I had in my heart, had alcohol and pot for a few months, and I got a whole different thing going on in my heart. And anyhow, so that came undone. And from there was, you know, the draft was going on. I got a student deferment. The draft was still going on, even though I had a student deferment. I don't know why they didn't stop it for me. No. Anyhow, so it came to pass, student deferment ran out, and I had passed my physical, and I got a telegram from the Marines on Friday, and they said, you're going to get drafted on Monday, so join the Marines. And so on Monday, I went down to the post office and applied for conscientious objector. And it took a couple of years to get that. I got that. And meanwhile, they started the draft lottery, and the draft lottery was everyone got a number, and you draft up to however high they go, and then you go. And I was 199 and they dropped it to 195. So this whole thing, like growing up, before I started getting wasted and stuff, life was beautiful, and there was no separation between me and my higher power, and love was the name of the game. And bringing to life, the vision and the image of the goodness of life. You know, if life is not worth living, it doesn't matter if we're drunk or sober. So there must be, you know, there's got to be meaning here. So what is it? When I was young, I was full of wanting to share meaning of life and the goodness of life and so on. When Vietnam was going on, and I remember when Robert Kennedy got shot and Martin Luther King got shot a couple months earlier. But the night Robert Kennedy got shot, I was sitting on a couch, and I was, you know, probably drunk or wasted anyhow, but emotionally I checked out. It's like, I'm not participating in this. I am not here for life to build a fortune or to build a life with somebody or to accomplish this or that. I'm on strike. I'm out. And I withdrew. And I withdrew for a number of years, and I lived in my car, and I got a drunk driving, and I wound up in a recovery house when I was 26 for about 6 weeks, and I got a job while I was there. And after about 5 or 6 weeks, the 4th of July came up, and they had an AA picnic, and the whole house went there. And I was in the house just to not live in the car. I was staying sober like I was supposed to, and I was doing the chores I was supposed to. But I was just there doing what I was supposed to, so I'd stay in the house. Anyhow, so we went to the AA picnic, and I was not plugged into sobriety. I was not embracing Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not embracing sobriety. And I went to the company picnic, and they had a couple of kegs of beer, and it had been 6 weeks since I had anything to drink, so I knew a couple of beers wouldn't hurt me none. And I had a couple of beers. And in a way, I think I was one of the lucky ones, because 9 years just went by. I never struggled to get sober after that. And lots of people do, right here, right now, struggling to be sober. And I just long, slow downhill. 20 months before I got sober, this woman friend, Laura, drowned. Her car was washed off the road in a storm. And after that happened, and we had kind of a relationship, but she was married but separated. I'd met her husband, her mom, her stepdad, her dad, you know, various people. But when she was washed off the road, there was no body. They were searching for a few days, and there was no funeral. There wasn't, you know, and I was not, at that time, I was drinking. I'd gotten sober for a while when I was first seeing her, but I was drinking by then, and I did not have a spiritual way of life to experience those emotions of loss of someone so precious to me. And so I just continued drinking. I remember the night, like, she drowned on a Saturday night, and I didn't find out about it till Monday morning on the news. They had a picture of her car, and the top of her car was peeled back like a sardine can. And I was in Refugio Canyon. And that night, I was smoking dope and drinking with a housemate. This guy had a two-bedroom apartment. I rented an apartment from him. And I felt the presence in the room. And she said, live. Just live. I thought, you know, if I just die, I could be with her forever. And that sounded like a pretty good idea. But she said, live. So anyhow, 20 months later, over those 20 months, at different times, I was thinking to see a therapist. Not doing it, but thinking about it. My mom stopped by my workshop one day and said, we noticed you haven't been happy for a while. And I said, yeah, that's right. And she said, we're wondering if you see this therapist. I said, sure. So I called this therapist, set up an appointment for the next day. And I got a hunch she's going to want me to not drink while we're taking care of my problems. And that day, or that not towards the end of that day, I had a couple of beers left in the fridge, and I finished them. And I had a couple of cigarettes left in my cigarette pack, and I finished them. And I figured early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. And that's what I was going to do. And so I went to bed, and it was 10 o'clock, and I couldn't get to sleep. And I got up at 11. I went to Safeway, and I got a pint of rum, and I got a liter of Coca-Cola, and I got a pack of Camel Straights. And I went home, and I watched the movie from 11 to 1. And I don't remember what that movie was, but the next movie from 1 to 3 was The Heart is a Lonely Hunter with Alan Arkin. And that was a metaphor of my life. Like some people here probably got to the end, like in a psych ward or with a car wrapped around a tree or in handcuffs or whatever. And the end of my drinking was like that feather in Forrest Gump, just floating down to the bench. I just drifted in. I was done. The first time I saw her the next day, it was like 3:02 in the morning, October 2nd. I looked at the clock. There's as much left in my glass. I tipped it up. And that was my last drink. And that was in 1984. And if I don't drink, and if I don't die, I'm going to celebrate 30 years, October 2nd. And that's cool. But what's really cool is that I'm sober August 16th, 2014, sharing that gift of sobriety with a whole bunch of people in this room. And you know, being sober today, I'll take today over 30 years if I had to choose. Today is the one that counts. I learned how to do it, and I do it. So I saw this therapist. And the first time I saw her, we talked about my friend that drowned and got some grief, expressed some grief. And she asked me, don't drink till you see me next week. And I said, sure. And out of the clear blue, one day, I'm swearing it off every morning, and by the afternoon, I'm starting up again, going as far as I can, and then swearing it off the next morning. And out of the clear blue, I'm saying yes. And I share at meetings sometimes that the day before I got sober, I had disdain for God, if there was a God. The day I was willing to be sober, it wasn't like God was suddenly in my life, but I experienced my willingness to be sober was grace and some kind of blessing, some kind of gift. And I've come to recognize that's my most precious gift in life. And if you have that gift, you know, just hold on to it with everything you can. There's one thing I wanted to share about my drinking days. It was kind of interesting. At one point along the way, I had way more than my share of psychedelics. And along the way, I had probably more than my share of pot. Definitely had more than my share of beer and so on. But anyway, along the way, I saw a psychiatrist. I was so out there, everything put me in an institution. And I saw a psychiatrist and talked to him about family background, drinking and using, whatever. I can't remember what I talked to him about, but I remember him saying to me that people in your circumstance usually go insane or kill themselves. And when he told me that, I had a picture of what he meant. And I was about 5 or 10 years sober when I got a different picture of what he meant. Because I think what he was talking about was alcoholism. And at that time, I thought he was talking about people that have 8 sisters. You know, if you have 8 sisters, you believe, man, you're going to go insane or kill yourself. But I don't think it was 8 sisters. I think it was talking about alcoholism. And I was sober a long time before I recognized that. So the second week I saw her, we started talking about alcoholism, and she asked me to read a book called Under the Influence. And it's about 4 stages of alcoholism. And it talks about first stage, having a large capacity to drink. Second stage, using alcohol for an emotional response to life. Third stage, having to drink to function. And 4th stage is cirrhosis or wet brain or death. And to me, that resonated. It's alcoholism. It's progressive. I have it. The outlook's not good. And I always thought that I certainly use it for emotional response to life. I had a large capacity to drink. I use it for emotional response to life. But for years and years and years, I didn't think that I had to have a drink to function. But just in the last 5 or 10 years, I realized I didn't have to function. You know? So if I'd had to show up at 7:30 at a job, I might have needed a drink. If I'd had dependence, I had to, or whatever, I might have needed a drink to get the wheels turning, to get it going again. But yeah, the point is that if you have it, if you have alcoholism, if you're like me, I have alcoholism. If I drink, a craving's going to kick in. I'm just one of these shooters real quick. Like I said, I love to drink. You know, nothing wrong with drinking. But as an alcoholic, I gotta make sure it's water, coffee, soda, juice, you know, whatever. Anyhow, so let's see, where was I? So stage of alcoholism. So third stage, gotta have it to function. Maybe yes, maybe no. I know there's some people in this room who certainly had to have a drink to function, and there's lots of people in this room that probably did not have to have a drink to function. But the point is that continuum, the progression, and suicide, insanity, incarceration, institutionalization, wet brain, cirrhosis, and death is what awaits us. So having that, I saw her the next week. So when I got sober, this is a one day at a time program. I was doing 1 week at a time with no effort. I was just glad the nightmare was over. I was glad to be dealing with my problems. I didn't know if I was going to drink once I took care of my problems, but I knew for the time being I wasn't going to be drinking. And so let's see here. So I went and saw her and talked about maybe my alcoholism. And she suggested I go to an AA meeting. And I had a brother-in-law from among all of my brother-in-laws. And there was an AA member and invited me over the years to an AA meeting. And so I called him up and I went to the Tuesday Men's Stag in Santa Barbara. And 4 months later, I was the secretary of that meeting. And probably 6 months later after that, I was all ready to drink. I wanted to drink. But I was secretary and I couldn't keep my commitment and drink. And being a secretary at that time helped me to stay sober. But anyhow, I wound up at Alcoholics Anonymous. I had 2 weeks sober when I got here. I heard amazing things here. I heard that, like a vision for you, and the sentence, we realize we know only a little, God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. And to me, that was a very humble thing, because they could have said, well, that's about it. It's all right here. And but in saying that we realize we know only a little, I realize I know only a little. And God constantly discloses more to me and discloses more to others around me, and I get to be in on that. And anyhow, so it's a living thing. It's full of vitality. It's full of human life. And there's a line in there. It's like the big book was, let me see. I just want to summarize what Alcoholics Anonymous means to me. Because without Alcoholics Anonymous, that guy in the picture hung himself. He's long gone. And today, I had a couple of cartons of ice cream over the last couple of days. And I went 30 or 40 days without any ice cream. But that's as close as I come to hanging myself. I just need a change of pace and a carton of ice cream. Anyhow, so I owe my life. And I mentioned about Catholicism, and I got nothing bad to say about Catholicism, but it was daunting to me that to be a full-on whatever, to know it really well or whatever. There was the Vatican Library full of books, and the Georgetown Library, and Loyola Marymount, and just big Catholic libraries everywhere. And it was just like impossible to wrap my head around, even if I was trying to. But when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, and there's 12 steps on it, that to me was a doorway to a spiritual life. And if you haven't, you know, this is the doorway. You're invited to walk through it. Nobody's going to force you to, but it's there and it's an opportunity. When Dr. Bob, when Bill Wilson was sober and he got to a spiritual experience with another person who was alcoholic, then Bill Wilson was 6 months sober and he was out of town and he was at a hotel, and I've been there. You go up these stairs and to the left, it's not a bar anymore. It's might be a dining room, I'm not sure. But to the right was a payphone. And the bar was beckoning to him, but he didn't want to drink more than anything. So he went to the payphone, and there was this glass church directory thing, and he called the church. He said, hey, you got anyone I can talk to? I need to talk to an alcoholic. And eventually he got hooked up with Dr. Bob. Anyhow, so this deal that worked with Bill and the guy that brought it to Bill worked with Bill and Dr. Bob. And we call that Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a name for something, just like we call this Earth. But Earth doesn't really begin to describe this place where we are here. So Alcoholics Anonymous, while it describes a lot, it doesn't really describe what we have going on. It points at it. And we point at that book. Because when they had it going on for about 4 years, and there's about 100 of them, they realized there's no way that they can tell everybody about what they found out, what's going on. There's no way they can just word of mouth tell it person to person. So they wrote a book, and they sent the book. There was an article in Saturday Evening Post. People heard about it, and the book got out. And do I go till straight up? Till 9 o'clock?
Sure.
Okay. Anyhow, so the book got out, and people got their hands on it. And when they got their hands on it, there was no meeting directories. There's 100 meetings within 50 miles of here every week. There was no meeting directories. There was no meetings, period. There was no AA phone numbers. There was no sponsors. There was no nothing. They wrote this book so that they could tell you precisely what they did to recover. And they mean precisely, they spelled it out really well in here. And one thing that I like in here, some people say that if it's not in the big book, it's not Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? Well, that's Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's a 12 of 12, and there's Living Sober, and there's a convention September 12th to the 14th, and those are all Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're not the heart of the thing. All these words point to the experience that we can have in life as human beings, relying on a power greater than ourselves, clear enough to rest of our past, learning to give freely of what we found. You know, cool, I got my goosebumps. So when it said that it's all in here it says precisely that. It says it's not all in here. It says we realize we know only a little. And so since they say, there's a disclaimer, like if there's a sign on the door, on the wall here that said, everyone on earth is in this room except the people who are not in this room, then it could be truthfully said that everyone on this earth is referred to right here among us. Because they said that they were not all here. Okay? So to say it's all here, well, it's all here because it says it's not all here. God will constantly disclose more to us. If they waited 10 more years to write the big book, which they could have done, it would have been this big. You know?
Yeah.
They had to get it out while they had it. Here. Timbuktu. Alcoholics Anonymous. Hope it works for you. Okay? So, and the newcomers here. This is one of my favorite lines, too. So this is towards the end of this first part of the book. It's about the disease and about the doctor's opinion. It's about talking about the physical craving that kicks in when we drink and about the mental obsession. My problem, first of all, I'm going to tell you about my problem, my condition. But first of all, in here it says, thus we grow and so can you, though you be but one man with this book in your hand. And that's right, this is the end of what they call the first 164 pages. It's right before that. One man with this book in your hand, we believe and hope it contains all you will need. And that's not what it says. It says, we believe and hope it contains all you will need to begin. So you're out in Timbuktu by yourself with this book in your hands. You have all you need to begin. Now, we have a maid because we have so many people. And we have people with boatloads of experience. If we all chipped in on writing a big book now, it could be, you know, six times bigger. What I'm saying in that is just to don't discount your personal experience of sobriety. It's valid. Even if it's not in there. I start my prayer saying, thank you. It's not in there. Okay, and so on. So, in a quick nutshell, I have a condition that if I drink, the physical craving is going to kick in. There's nothing I can do about it. It's always been true. It always will be true. It's a condition. Nothing I can do about it. Then for a long time, I had a problem in my thinking that it'll be okay to drink this time. I'm only going to have two. I'm going to switch to something else. I'm not going to drink till sometime or whatever. And that thinking was a problem because, to me, by definition, something's not a problem unless there's a solution. And that's not in the Big Rip. Okay? And I'm not saying I'm inventing this stuff. I'm just saying it's really powerful to me to know that by default, every problem in life is a problem because there is a solution. And my problem is not that physical craving. My problem is my thinking that it doesn't matter. So if you're new here and you're thinking it don't matter, or I can't do it, or what's the use, or I'm only going to have two, we invite you to be with us till your thinking changes, because it will. And I want to thank Derek for asking me to talk, and all of you for hanging in there with me on it. And I'm sure I have more to say. I know it's past nine, so I'm just going to finish off with one more example for the newcomer. It's okay if you love to drink. And it was Miller time.
Go Billy, chug love.
Okay, thank you.